in the back. I don't see the microphone up here, so if we need one, I will need to have one brought up to me. If not, we're good. Well, good morning. We certainly have many visitors with us this morning. It's so good to have you with us. As Brother Ken mentioned, you are our honored guest, and we are excited to have you here. If you are visiting, I am not Shane Scott. Shane is gallivanting across Europe like some sort of European, looking at the various sites of the war and enjoying a well-earned vacation. So I'll be filling in for him this morning, and then Brother Ralph Walker will be filling in for him this evening. I will try not to, but make no promises. All right, thank you. As was mentioned a couple of times today, today is Mother's Day. If you forgot that, I highly encourage, make sure you make a phone call or go get a card from the nearby CVS, because mothers are incredibly important. We see throughout the Bible that there are many mentions of them, 304 in fact, and I plan on going through every single one of those today, so we should be here right about 8 o'clock. We see mothers mentioned many times, particularly in the Old Testament. The patriarchs' wives are mentioned often just as important characters in their stories as them. Moses' mother, Jochebed, plays a great part in the early part of his story. And obviously, the mother of our Savior, Mary, plays a very important part in the beginning of his story. And there are many other passages that extol the virtues of a good mother, of a good wife. Proverbs 31 is probably the most famous one that comes to mind, extolling the worth of a good woman as being worth more than rubies. Technology is not in our favor this morning. Is it the green button? There we go. Worth far more than rubies. Sometimes it's just user error. And there are passages that extol these women's virtue as being worth far more than rubies, that they are able to bring great honor to their households, that they are able to maintain a steady living for their families, and they bring great children up in the service of the Lord. And so we can look at any number of mothers in the Bible today for positive examples, but I want to take the time today to look at one that is probably not often on the list of those mothers we look at for their positive virtues. Turn over, if you will, to 2 Samuel chapter 11. It's one of those passages that probably you recognize where we're going to. We're going to look today at the story of Bathsheba. Bathsheba does not tend to be one of the characters we look at for the positive traits of her motherhood. At best, she tends to be kind of an awkward side character in a very awkward narrative about the great failing of King David, of his sexual sin. At worst, I've seen her portrayed in some literature as being a cause of this great sin, that she was some sort of great temptress, that she was attempting to seduce her way to the crown. And so Bathsheba tends to not be extolled for her virtue. At best, she is ambivalent, and at worst, perhaps she is a negative character. What I want to take the time to look at today is who Bathsheba is. What role does she play in this sin of David's? And then what is the rest of her story? What happens to her after this well-known narrative? What role does she play as a wife to a king and later to a mother of King Solomon? We're all fairly familiar with the story of Bathsheba and David. We know that in 2 Samuel chapter 11, King David is in the midst of kind of the height of his kingdom. He has successfully ruled over both Judah and Israel. Saul's kingdom has dissolved. He is king over all of Israel. He has become very successful in conquering new lands for God. Many foreign peoples have fallen by his blade. He is at the height of his power. And at the very end of chapter 10, it talks about David's army achieving a great victory over a people called the Arameans. And after that, they go out to fight another people, the Ammonites. And it says in verse 1 of chapter 11, that it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. So from the very beginning, it's an important point to make here that David is not where he's supposed to be. The text very clearly lays out that this was the expected custom of kings, that they would go out at this time with their troops and they would lead their forces in battle. And for whatever reason, David doesn't do that. We don't know exactly why. We don't know if he felt there was more pressing concerns at home. Maybe he didn't think this was that big of a battle to be at. But David's not where he should normally be in the large scheme of things. And he continues that in verse 2, where it says, "Now evening came, and David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful in appearance." Now, if you've never been over to the Middle East or any of these areas or seen pictures of the architecture here, this might sound a little bit weird from our perspective, because we're very used to houses and buildings kind of all being generally on the same level. And we're used to fairly sloped roofs that are used primarily for keeping the rain out of the rest of the house. That wasn't quite the same way that architecture worked in this time period or even today in the Near East. What you tended to see is that most houses tended to have very flat level areas. And these houses, their roof was used as an additional space for the family during the day. Again, it's obviously a very hot climate. Most of the time, the roof was an area where you could go, you could relax, and that actually tended to be where you would bathe, because they obviously did not have indoor plumbing of any sort. They would take the water that they were going to use to bathe, they would take it up to the roof, leave it out in the sun all day so that it would warm up, and then in the evening time, they would go up and they would use that time to bathe. And they would erect some sort of curtain or some sort of palisade to prevent other people on the roof from viewing them. But David does not live in a normal house. David lives on a palace that is already at an elevated platform in Jerusalem. So from David's balcony, David would be able to look out and essentially see the entire city, including the roofs. And so David, in a place where he should not be, at a time where he should not be looking, he would know this would be a time where people might be bathing. He's looking out onto the roofs, and lo and behold, he sees a beautiful woman bathing. In this scenario, there's no real harm by the woman done. She's doing what would be expected of that custom. The text gives no indication that she's intentionally luring David into some trap. It's no intention that she's being immodest in some way. This is a case of a king being where he should not be and looking where he should not. And so the text continues, and David, upon seeing how beautiful this woman is, he sends in verse 3 and inquires about the woman. And one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Now, those names might not mean anything to you right off the top of your head, but turn over, if you will, to the end of 2 Samuel in verse 23, or in chapter 23, excuse me. At the end of this book, there's some kind of chronicle that kind of talks about the accomplishments of King David's reign, and David kind of takes stock of where his kingdom has arrived. And in chapter 23, he talks about his mighty men. And these are the great warriors of King David's realm, his generals, his captains, his bodyguards. These are his closest comrades. These are good men, and these are wise men. These are men that have fought valiantly, both for David and for God. And if you skip down to verse 34, past several of these names, in verse 34, amongst the list of names, it says, "Eliphelet, the son of Arhashbi, the son of Maacathite, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite." And then just a couple verses later, in verse 39, it says Uriah the Hittite, making 37 in all. So both of these men that are mentioned in conjunction with Bathsheba are amongst David's closest comrades, his mighty men. So Bathsheba has both been raised in the house of one of David's mighty warriors, but she has also been married into one of the houses of David's mighty warriors. So Bathsheba is not just some woman in this story. From this text, we can already tell that she is somewhat of a high-born woman, but she is also a woman from good households, that both her father and her husband were considered amongst the preeminent men of Israel at this time. These were men that would have been counted as faithful and righteous men. I think it's important that we get that perspective on Bathsheba from the beginning. And so up until this point, we've had no mention of Bathsheba doing anything herself. We haven't really seen what exactly she's reacting to this situation. But in verse 4, it says that David sent messengers and took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." Now, from an English translation, this seems like a fairly clear-cut and straightforward passage. David asks for her to come. She comes up. They have relations. She goes back. She becomes pregnant. But the Bible, like much other literature, tends to use certain words to kind of allude to more heinous actions. The word take here, when it says that David sent messengers and took her, that word typically has a sense of force, a sense of forced compliance. And so it does not appear to be that David happens to send a question and say, hey, would you like to come up to my house? That's not the sense that this verse really gives. This is less of a person asking a question and more of the sense of a king with absolute authority sending a messenger and telling a woman what is to occur. Now remember, both her husband and her father are mighty men. And we've just read that all of Israel, all of the army, is away. Bathsheba is by herself, and she is being forced by the king to come to his house. The threat is not spoken, but in this culture, defying a king does not often have good ramifications. And so Bathsheba is put in a very no-win situation here. And the text, interestingly, does not condemn her. The text takes no time to note that Bathsheba was willing to do this, that Bathsheba was looking for this at all. All the blame in this text lays upon David. And it's important to note that when this occurs, Bathsheba does not stay in David's house. She does not start to institute herself as queen. She does not see this as an opportunity for social rising. She rises, she cleans herself, and she goes home. She gets out of the situation. And it is not until she conceives and figures out that she is pregnant that she goes back and sees David. And so through the first five verses of this situation, I don't think we see a woman looking for a chance to be a queen. I don't think we see a woman looking to take advantage of a situation. I think we see a woman without the protection of her husband or her father put in a very dangerous situation. And I think she was put in a situation that there was no winning. And so after verse 5, the text kind of backs away from Bathsheba herself. The story continues on as we know that David now becomes the central character and seeks to cover up what has happened. David is well aware that this is his sin. And so he tries to cover it up, and it speaks to the character of Uriah, that Uriah does not fall prey to David's traps and tries to keep himself in a good situation. And so David ends up killing Uriah. And if we skip ahead to verse 26, after the foul deed is done and after Uriah is killed in battle, it says in verse 26 that now when the wife of Uriah, interesting that she's still called that, heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought to her to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. Again, it's interesting that the text specifically condemns David as having done something evil in the sight of the Lord, but does not condemn Bathsheba. Again, she mourns her husband. She appears to have had a genuine relationship with Uriah the Hittite. And when he passes away, she mourns as would be expected of any wife in that situation. And again, now without the protection of a husband, she is once again forced, I think, by David to come into this situation. Again, a woman with no husband, born with a son, has very little prospects, has very little protection in a world that would require it. So it is interesting that throughout this entire text, Bathsheba is not condemned, and it appears that she is truly the victim of a terrible circumstance. We know that in chapter 12, the prophet Nathan comes and rebukes David in some of the strongest terms given in his entire reign. Nathan does not spare David's feelings. He does not beat around the bush. He says point blank, you have sinned before God. You have caused God to be blasphemed among the nations. And you, David, are going to be punished for what has happened. And we know that the story continues that the child that Bathsheba bears is struck down by the Lord. We see that David mourns for this child. But in verse 24 of chapter 12, it also says that David comforted his wife Bathsheba. Again, Bathsheba is portrayed as a victim here. Through no fault of her own, Bathsheba has now lost not only her husband, but a child as well. This is a tragic situation for Bathsheba. Her entire world has been upended by forces outside of her control. And yet, we finally get a picture of her response. Throughout most of this text, she's been almost a passive character. These things have been done to her. But it says in verse 24 that he went in and lay with her again, and she gave birth to a son. And David named him Solomon. Now the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet, and he named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. We'll come back to this, but Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord. It appears as if throughout this entire situation, Bathsheba did not lose her faith. That even in the midst of what would probably be the worst possible situation for her, she stayed faithful to her God. Her son is named after the Lord that she loves and she serves. We often talk about David's response in this situation, about how David, when confronted with his sin, repents and realizes his error and tries to make up for what he has done. But Bathsheba, I think, is the hero of this story. That in the midst of horrible things happening to her, in the midst of being unable to fight back, she maintains a faith in the Lord. May we all have that same sort of courage to be able to stand up not only for us, but for our children and our families in the face of struggles. Bathsheba does not play much of a role in the rest of the narrative of 2 Samuel. But at the end of David's life, as is portrayed in the first chapter of 1 Kings, Bathsheba reemerges. The rest of David's reign goes downhill from here. This sin with Bathsheba is sort of the pinnacle and the death knell of David's reign. David faces multiple insurrections. He faces civil war against his own son, Absalom. His eldest son, Amnon, is murdered because he slept with his sister. David's reign ends in calamity and disappointment and pestilence. And so in 1 Kings, we see David as an old, beaten, downtrodden man. And we come into a new situation. The king is dying. The king is old. Now what? Who's going to succeed David? From all indications, David doesn't do a very good job of clarifying what's supposed to happen when he dies. He doesn't issue some sort of official proclamation. He makes no decrees. And so, if David dies with no heir declared, it's going to be a free-for-all. Whoever can have the best claim to the throne and can enforce that claim would become king. And so one of David's sons, by the name of Adonijah, who seems to be very similar in character to Absalom and Amnon, decides that he is going to be king. He prepares for himself an army, he loops in some of David's key advisors, and he begins essentially a campaign and a thrust to become king even before David has passed away. This is a dangerous situation for any of the sons of David, but for Bathsheba and Solomon as well. Because if Adonijah becomes king, essentially without an official decree, there are other sons that could say, well, maybe I should be king instead. And so what would often be the case in situations like this is that the winner would make sure to kill or exile the losers. And so all of David's other sons would be under threat in this circumstance. And so we come upon Bathsheba in verse 11 of 1 Kings chapter 1. Nathan, the same prophet that had rebuked David, spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, saying, "Have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king, and David our Lord does not know it? So now come, please let me give you counsel and save your life and the life of your son Solomon. Go at once to King David and say to him, 'Have you not, my lord, O king, sworn to your maidservant, saying, surely Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne? Why then has Adonijah become king? Behold, when you are still there speaking with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words.'" Bathsheba is being asked to do a pretty difficult thing here. She's being asked to go to the king in his personal chambers and tell him, "You're not doing your job. You're not even aware of what's going on in your kingdom. Right outside your door, your son is usurping your crown. And that's not what you swore. You made a promise. Now hold it." That's a tough thing to say to a king that, again, not only still has that same power, but this is the same man who upended her life. We don't get a very clear picture of David and Bathsheba's relationship outside of that brief comforting that David gives after their son's death. But a man with multiple wives likely did not have a particularly close relationship with any one of them. And so this is not necessarily the same instance of a modern wife going to a modern husband and counseling him. This is a woman separated by a barrier of royal lineage, going to God's anointed king and telling him he's not doing the right job. Bathsheba very easily could have said, it's not in my power. I don't think I can do this thing. Solomon and I will just go run away. We'll get out of here. We'll find some other way. But instead we see that in verse 15, that Bathsheba went into the king in the bedroom. And now the king was very old, and Abishag the Shunammite was ministering to the king. Then Bathsheba bowed and prostrated herself before the king. And David said, what do you wish? She said to him, my lord, you swore to your maidservant, by the Lord your God, saying, surely your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Now behold, Adonijah is king, and now my lord, you do not know. He has sacrificed oxen and fatlings and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the sons of the king and Abiathar the priest and Joab the commander. But he has not invited Solomon your servant. As for you now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will come about as soon as my lord the king sleeps with his fathers that I and my son Solomon will be considered offenders. She goes right in and tells David what he's doing wrong. You're not being a king. You're not controlling your kingdom. You're not controlling your sons as you have failed to do so for these many years. The kingdom is falling apart because you won't step up and make the decree. So now, king, are you going to hold to your promise? Nathan comes in as he had promised, and Nathan also offers a similar report that Adonijah is usurping the throne. And so it comes in verse 28 that after Nathan has finished his speech, King David said, call Bathsheba to me. And she came into the king's presence and stood before the king. The king vowed and said, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, surely as I vowed to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place. I will indeed do so this day. Then Bathsheba bowed with her face to the ground and prostrated herself before the king and said, may my lord King David live forever. If Bathsheba does not do what she does in this circumstance, if she does not risk everything to correct the king, not only would her own personal fate and that of Solomon's have been different, but that of Israel itself. Adonijah, if he is anything like his two brothers, Absalom and Amnon, was not a good man. He would not have been a good king. And so through her courage and through her trust in the Lord and his prophet Nathan, Bathsheba saves her son and the entire kingdom. This is a woman of great courage and great faith, and a woman who is willing to risk everything for her children and her country. She is an admirable woman from the actions we see. And part of that admiration should also come from what we know of King Solomon. David's track record with sons is not good. The three sons we see, Absalom, Amnon, and Adonijah, are between the three of them murderers, usurpers, and instigators of civil war. David does not appear to have been a particularly adept father. Whether it was because he was too busy running the kingdom, whether it was because he just didn't know how to do it, whatever it may have been, his sons, by the whole, did not turn out very well. And yet in contrast to that, Solomon, in his youth, prays to the Lord. He asks for wisdom. He tries to govern efficiently. And we know as an older man, he falls away. But the character of his youth speaks highly of those who raised him. And it doesn't appear as if it was much of King David. Bathsheba would have been the counselor of King Solomon's youth. And so King Solomon's good character in the first part of his reign, his wisdom, and his desire to serve the Lord speaks well of Bathsheba. We don't get a whole lot of specific instances where Bathsheba advises Solomon. But I think we may see one. This morning we read from Proverbs 31. Turn over there if you will. As Chase read for us, Proverbs 31 comes from a different source than most of the Proverbs. We know that Solomon is renowned as the author of the Proverbs by and large. But chapter 31 comes from a different source. In Proverbs 31 and verse 1, it says, "The words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him." We don't have definitive proof who exactly this King Lemuel is. Different theories have been postulated. But the name Lemuel means dedicated or devoted of the Lord. You may notice that sounds fairly familiar to another name that we pointed out earlier, Jedidiah, beloved of the Lord. One of the great theories of chapter 31 is that this is still King Solomon speaking, but this is not Solomon speaking the oracles that have been given to him specifically by God, but that this is the oracle, the wisdom, that his mother taught him as a young boy. Chase read for us the advice that his mother gave to a young king: to avoid strong drink, to open your mouth, to judge righteously, to defend the needs of the afflicted and needy. And then the rest of the chapter is probably one of the most famous and one of the most studied for women of all time: the description of a worthy woman. And King Lemuel's mother describes an excellent wife, how her worth is far above jewels. And it says in verse 11 that the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night, gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arm strong. She senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff. Her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates, and when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, supply belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her. Her husband also, and he praises her, saying, "Many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates." It would be a very interesting coda to the kingships of both David and Solomon if that the last words we get of Solomon are essentially the words that he was taught when he was young by his mother. And I think there is evidence for this to be the case. That Proverbs 31 is Bathsheba trying to instruct her young son Solomon. This is the kind of woman you can marry. This is how you can be a good king. This is how you can be a good man. And this is how you can lead in a way that is worthy of your calling. Bathsheba is an interesting character. A character that, for the most part, seems to have been acted upon rather than acted. And yet, in the midst of difficult situations, in the midst of games of politics and of kingdoms, she handles herself with grace, with courage, and with faith in her God. And she instructs her children to act in the same way. Is that not what we would wish for all mothers? To have courage under stressful situations, to have grace under fire, and to raise up their families and their children in the ways befitting the Lord. Mother's Day is a day to reflect, to think upon the benefit that we have had from our own mothers and those who have served as mother figures to us. It is a day to praise those who continue in those tasks, who are raising young children. Sitting next to my son Thomas, who I love but is a pain in the tail sometimes, I'm often reminded of how tough it is to be a mother. I go to work, I deal with things at work, but I don't stay home with my children all day. I am not the primary raiser of my children. I recognize this. Much of the fate of my daughters and my son will hinge upon the raising that my wife is doing for them. And I am grateful for the mother that my wife has become. And I'm grateful for the many mothers in this congregation that continue to help my wife and to help my children to grow in the Lord. And I pray this day, as we consider Bathsheba, as we consider the words of Proverbs 31, that the women in this congregation would continue to serve with grace, that they would continue to reflect, to edify one another, to build one another up, to serve as good mothers and wives and sisters and daughters. And I would encourage us men that this is a day not just for praise and reflection, but also to look inwards. Not just because Father's Day is around the corner, but because we have an obligation to support the women in our lives. An obligation to raise them up, to build them up, to support them in their great works that they do. We are blessed to be a family under the Lord. We are blessed to have many fathers and mothers and many brothers and sisters. So as we conclude this day, I pray that you reflect upon the blessings of family. And I pray that if you are in this audience and you don't know those blessings, if you find yourself lonely in this world, perhaps your physical mother and father have not been there for you. Perhaps your physical family has failed you. There is a spiritual family that is more than happy to embrace you. There is a Father above who desperately wants to see you as his child again. If we can help in that capacity, water is prepared. We would love to baptize you into that family. Or if you have stumbled in some capacity and you need the prayers of this family here, let us know what we can do for you while we stand and while we sing.